The lecture this week is The Internet as a Super Commons, Week 9. And the themes for this week are going to be about why does the Internet function as a commons? What is it that makes it a hosting infrastructure for the commons? And then we'll talk about free software, which was a pioneering digital commons, as well as an infrastructure for building all sorts of other commons on top of it. We'll talk about how it arose and developed, and particularly the role of Richard Stallman in getting free software going and the general public license. And this is will be a discussion to precede next week's lecture, which will talk about all sorts of collaborative enterprises and commonses and open business models that have been built on top of the internet and free and open source software. So let's start with, where did the internet come from? Now, a lot of people think that the corporate world was the originator of the internet. They don't realize that really it was government that was primarily responsible for moving it forward as it has become known. It was incubated in the Advanced Research Projects Agency at the Department of Defense. Virtually all of the critical technologies of the internet and the World Wide Web originated from the government in one fashion or another, mostly within the Department of Defense. There were a number of free market online services. CompuServe and Prodigy were two of the more prominent ones. But they ultimately failed. And it wasn't because of the government competition, but because they were chiefly inferior technologies working within a closed proprietary system. And they just couldn't compete with an open system, which was far more versatile and flexible and could evolve in superior ways to a closed system. Now, that's a long and complicated story unto itself that we won't be getting into. What I want to focus on is how DARPA, the Department, Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, incubated the internet by designing what an early precursor of the internet called ARPANET, which was designed to be a hardy, flexible communication system that could withstand nuclear war or any interruption of any of the nodes of it. And what was notable about this, it was built by the users themselves. So a lot of academic researchers and military personnel built by them themselves through a process called RFCs, Request for Comments. So it wasn't a top-down, hierarchical-driven process, but a development process that came from the bottom up. And therefore, it met users' needs more intimately, more subtly, than a market or hierarchy-driven communication structure would have been. And it's also notable that government had a longer-term vision than most private companies would in designing the internet. Most companies would focus on the marketability of the content or the project, not on the absolute best quality or its usability by users. It would focus chiefly on, can it make money? Can we sell it? Is it a good advertising vehicle? To be fair, the government also had considerably more research and development resources to invest in the process. But it also had something that proprietary companies wouldn't generally have adopted, which is open technical standards, so that everyone could interconnect with each other. That was one of the prime purposes, to allow disparate types of computer networks to be able to intercommunicate on the same system. How can all sorts of technically incompatible networks interact and communicate with each other? This was a major challenge, a design challenge. And the way that there are a number of design principles that are important to understand about why the internet works the way it does. One was the idea of packet switching. Now, this was a way of breaking up communications information, be it voice or data, into packets, data packets, which could then be split up and sent across a network along different paths, if necessary, to the other end, where they'd be reassembled into the voice or text or whatever kind of data it was. And this was a radical departure from the traditional way that the telephone companies operated. And in fact, the telephone companies, AT&T, actively resisted and opposed this kind of design architecture, thinking it was at first technically impractical, and later they saw it as a threat to its business model. But the Department of Defense saw packet switching as a way to have a more redundant and therefore more reliable communication system. And also, since the communications could travel on a network, split up, and then reassembled, it would be less vulnerable to interruptions anywhere on the network. So in theory, packet switching could be far faster, more efficient, and therefore could use less of the wire, and the wire could transmit more information through it. So the DARPA insisted on this, despite opposition from the telephone companies, and won. And a new this helped make possible a new architecture of end-to-end communications, as it's called. E2E, it's often referred to. Now, the end-to-end principle is one of the central engineering design principles of the Internet, and it's implemented in the design of the underlying protocols of networking. And the key protocols, which we don't need to go into any technical detail, are known as TCP/IP, which stands for Transmission Control Protocol Internet Protocol. The point is those protocols allowed multiple networks of different technical standards to intercommunicate on the same platform, the Internet. Now, one of the key principles was that the network itself should be dumb, so to speak, and all the intelligence should be on the ends through smart terminals or the PCs. The idea was that rather than have the network contain embedded protocols that would have the sophisticated ways of channeling or massaging or organizing information, all of that would occur on the ends in people's personal computers. Or at the time, personal computers hadn't been invented, but the terminals at the end. And notably, the control would not be exercised from a centralized point, the way broadcasting and other mass media of the 20th century have. So this represented a profound shift from the mass media broadcast model of the 20th century. The end-to-end principle states that whenever possible, communication protocol operations should occur at the endpoints of the system or as close as possible to the resource being controlled. This allowed for maximum freedom and control at the ends of the network rather than in a centralized system. And as we'll see, especially next week, this has profound implications for the political freedom and innovation that can occur on the network. Because when it can occur on the ends in a decentralized fashion, those users have those freedoms rather than a small group of elite professionals at the centralized hub of the communication system. Mitch Kapoor, one of the early entrepreneurs of software, once memorably said, "Architecture is politics." And by that he meant the design of the network has all sorts of political implications for the freedom and innovation that can occur on the network. And this is a theme that Professor Lawrence Lessig famously took up in his 1999 book, Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, where he, as we discussed earlier, I believe, raised the idea that this end-to-end principle and other design elements were critical to having freedom. This was not a naturally occurring thing, and most notably, it wasn't something that the corporate world had designed into it, because indeed it would be very disruptive to many of their existing business models. Now, Professor Lessig, drawing upon a lot of the work by Professor Yochai Benkler, this leading theorist of the commons in digital spaces, talked about the different layers of the internet. And by this, he meant the different layers of design. At the bottom layer, so to speak, you have the physical layer, the hardware, and how that hardware can operate. At the next layer, you have the code level or software level. This is where the TCP/IP protocols were working, and they determined how the network could communicate with itself, how the ends could communicate with other ends. And then there was a layer on top of that, which is the content layer, where the video, the audio, or the text, or whatever, would be structured. So this would be like the software on one's personal computer as opposed to the network software. And the point of all this is that higher layers of complexity and variations in how communications could occur would sit on top of the lower layers. So if the bottom physical layer allowed for the maximum freedom and intelligence on the edges, you could build that up on the subsequent software and content layers as well. And this is one reason why all sorts of innovations that were never dreamed of when the internet was designed in the 60s and 70s, why they could be imagined and created and built on top of the network decades later. Nobody imagined something like the World Wide Web, or at least didn't try to operationalize it in the 60s or 70s. That only occurred when Tim Berners-Lee developed the HTTP protocols and put them on the internet in the 1990s, leading to what we now know as the World Wide Web and the massive explosion of that. And that was only possible because the network was open and available to anyone, and the end-to-end communication could occur. That allowed it to scale up with mass participation and people's innovations contributing to it. The same with the so-called Web 2.0 software platforms, the social networking, the streaming video, the voice over internet protocols that were later developed. They could only be added to the internet because its design allowed it to be added later. And this is why the internet has been so profoundly the infrastructure for profound innovation, because it was designed that way in the first place. And one lesson that we need to draw from this is that there are very far-reaching, profound implications for whether a layer of the internet, physical, logical, or content, is open or closed, whether it's controlled and proprietary or free for everyone to use. Political freedom, competition, innovation, all of these are wrapped up in the design of the internet. And with end-to-end computing design, end-to-end internet design, and then openness on these other layers, people on the edge of the network can innovate, can communicate, can have freedom, and centralized sources can't suppress that freedom. The network can evolve and host new innovation. The network can't discriminate against newcomers who have their own innovations. That's precisely why Google, YouTube, Facebook, and dozens of other startups were able to enter the internet and compete without having the incumbent companies shut them down through anti-competitive activities or design principles. And that is why net neutrality, the principle of non-discrimination as a formal policy affecting cable companies and cable broadband companies and telephone companies, why net neutrality is so important in those industries today, and why we have to preserve it. Because without that, those principles of non-discrimination and the freedom for everybody to intercommunicate without any company or source interfering, the innovation and freedom can be shut down. So it's a very important principle. Now, the internet, therefore, was the hosting infrastructure for a lot of things. And in the mid-80s, there was, on the code layer, a commonly used software program was something called Unix, UNIX. AT&T had developed Unix and essentially gave it away, especially to academic researchers. And at the time, AT&T was a regulated monopoly, so it didn't really need to hold tight to that software to make money from it. It considered it was making money through the usage of its wires and its hardware, not from the software. So Unix became the standard operating system for interconnecting computers. Now, around 1984, after a long legal battle, AT&T was broken up. It was a monopoly and it was broken up to allow competition among telephone companies. Well, AT&T promptly seized upon Unix to make it as a proprietary asset and wanted to make money for it. And so it started to tell the academic computer scientists and others who relied upon Unix that they would now have to start paying a licensing fee, which of course angered them a great deal because they had invested a lot of time and lots of functionalities on that software. Well, this helped prod Richard Stallman, who was then a hacker at the MIT computer labs, to build his own Unix-like system that would not be hampered by proprietary controls, that anybody could use in an open commons. And he started what he called the GNU project, which stands for GNU's Not Unix, to build the components of an operating system. This is a tremendously formidable, if not some regarded as impossible, task. He started in the mid-80s, started something called the Free Software Foundation in 1985 to help promote this vision. And a lot of people regarded it as a fringe utopian scheme because the trend was to turn software into a proprietary product, something that was owned through copyright or patent. But Stallman regarded this as anathema. He said, "I consider that the golden rule requires that if I like a program, I must share it with other people who like it. Software sellers want to divide the users and conquer them, making each user agree not to share with others. I refuse to break solidarity with other users in this way. I cannot in good conscience sign a non-disclosure agreement or a software license agreement. For years, I worked with the Artificial Intelligence Lab to resist such tendencies and other inhospitalities, but eventually they had gone too far. I could not remain in an institution where such things are done for me against my will." So Stallman quit his affiliation with MIT and launched out on a rather lonely, brave road to design his own free computer operating system. And I was just reading from the GNU Manifesto that Stallman wrote. And he declared four freedoms that were essential for himself as a programmer. One is the freedom to run the program for any purpose. The second was to study how it works and to adapt it to his own needs. The third was to redistribute copies so that you could help your neighbor. And the fourth was to improve the program and release improvements to the public so that the whole community could benefit from those improvements. Now, Stallman's signal innovation and contribution, which persists to this day, was the invention of what is often called a hack around copyright law. Copyright law requires that everything is born in an envelope of property rights, private property rights, and cannot be easily shared unless specific affirmative steps are made to allow that. Well, Stallman created what's called the General Public License, or GPL, as a legally enforceable means to keep code available to everyone, as in a commons. Now, this was a stark contrast to the way Microsoft was growing its new company, where it used proprietary code that could not be looked at, could not be altered or improved by users. It controlled it. And Stallman wanted to create a whole body of code that anybody could look at, anybody could improve, anybody could share and copy for whatever purpose. And what the GPL did was create, prevented appropriation of the code by others to take it private. It prevented the destruction of the commons. And so you had a legally defensible commons of online code, which was a significant innovation, as we'll see. Let me just digress a moment for a great essay that Eben Moglen wrote. Eben Moglen is a Columbia University law professor who had clerked for Thurgood Marshall and is a self-proclaimed anarchist. He wrote an essay in the late 90s called Anarchism Triumphant. And what's notable about it is it set forth a different theory of creativity incentives and incentives for it, and attacked copyright regime as destructive of the kind of commons-based creativity that Stallman was trying to develop. It's a very flamboyant, provocative essay that, for example, calls economists econo-dwarfs because they're committed to a logic over experience and specialize in an energetic and well-focused but entirely erroneous view of human nature. Moglen instead put forward the proposition that in a memorable phrase, if you wrap the internet around every person on the planet and spin the planet, software flows in the network. It's an emergent property of connected minds that they create things for one another's pleasure and to conquer their uneasy sense of being too alone. The only question to ask, what's the resistance of the network? Moglen's metaphorical corollary to Ohm's law states that the resistance of the network is directly proportional to the field strength of the intellectual property system. So the right answer to the econo-dwarf is resist the resistance. Moglen's point was to show that people could create and share without the incentives they supposedly needed through copyright law. It happens naturally. And the power of that natural creativity and sharing is amplified exponentially on the internet, which, you know, if you wrap the internet around every person on the planet and spin it, software flows in the network. Well, this could be elaborated 10 years later to creativity flows in the network, again, contrary to the basic foundational premises of copyright law, which asserts that you need those incentives. One point that Moglen was trying to make was that copyright was destructive of creating good software. And he pointed out that the Microsoft business model, in his words, precluded the Lamarckian inheritance of software improvements. Lamarck, of course, was the evolutionary scientist who said that innovations could be inherited by the next species and passed on, and that's how the species advanced. Well, similarly, open source software, free software, could incorporate the improvements of people, the innovations, and each generation could therefore improve, which the Microsoft business model wouldn't allow because they would only release new improvements every couple of years, whereas the free software could happen in a matter of weeks. So free software was on a path for becoming a more robust, innovative evolutionary model than the traditional proprietary model. Moglen said that proprietarian regimes not only do not make things better, they can make things radically worse. Property concepts, whatever else may be wrong about them, do not enable and in fact have retarded progress. Moglen was saying that anarchism is a mode of production. Some people might quarrel with the word anarchism because it is so freighted with the history of Russian anarchists and Peter Kropotkin and so forth. But by that he meant the mutual aid and the self-organizing of people to cooperate, which was, in fact, a functional aspect of free software and continues to this day. And Moglen pointed out that the GPL prevents enclosure of that commons. As he puts it, because defection is impossible, free riders are welcome, which resolves one of the central puzzles of collective action in a proprietarian social system. Free software welcomes free riders because free riders can't take it private, can't take the code private. And so anybody who participates can help improve the system. And so it has this viral capacity to improve over time. Now, the development of Linux, the operating system, of course, is a longer, more complicated story. Let's just note that Linus Torvalds, a Finnish student, created a kernel for a Unix-like operating system and released it onto the internet in 1991. And when it, the kernel, was combined with a lot of the programs that Stallman and his colleagues had created through free software and the GPL, it created an integrated, fully functioning operating system, which most computer scientists had regarded as an impossibly complex project that could never occur. Yet here you had the internet and the collaboration of hundreds, if not thousands, of volunteers creating a functional, if not in many ways, in many respects, a superior operating system than the ones that were known at the time. And it became such a phenomena that IBM, in an act of strategic brilliance, embraced open source software as the basis for its new competitive business strategy. It embraced, for example, the open source Apache server software, and then it embraced Linux and spent $1 billion a year to help build and improve it as an open source system available to everyone. Now, this was so counterintuitive because the assumption was you had to have exclusive proprietary rights in something to make money from it. But over time, IBM has made this such a success that it now makes more money from its Linux-related services and technical support than it does from its own considerable patent portfolio. It also saw Linux, the promotion of Linux as an excellent software system, as a way to help it sell more of its own hardware and consulting services. So this approach has been emulated by a number of other computer companies, Hewlett-Packard, Oracle, and others, if only because they saw it as a way to compete more effectively against Microsoft, which was such a dominant force in computing. Now, the rise of GNU Linux, as it's often called among free software aficionados, helps demonstrate the power of open platforms for hosting innovation. It's far better, faster, and cheaper than the proprietary systems. There's a lower barrier to entry for newcomers, so you don't have to be a credentialed expert or a part of a company to participate. And the GPL license assured that the innovation wouldn't be taken private in the future. So the rise of Linux and the internet sets the stage for a major confrontation between old-style ideas about how innovation occurs through exclusive ownership and control, copyrights and patents, and decentralized innovation on the internet, which tends to emerge from the edges on this open platform. Sometimes they're open platform businesses, sometimes they're more socially managed commonses. But the point is, a serious new mode of production was arising, in which the users were creators themselves rather than simply consumers of what sellers were selling. Now, one of the classic essays describing this new dichotomy in software development is Eric Raymond's The Cathedral and the Bazaar, which was published in 1998. And Raymond put forward an analysis of why free software worked, why it was more a better kind of software, and why it was more effective than the proprietary software of the time. And he used the analogy of the cathedral as a place which is a grand centralized location where there's this priesthood of people who control how the software develops. And the obvious reference is to Microsoft. And then there's the bazaar, the B-A-Z-A-A-R, the agora, the open marketplace, where people of all different backgrounds can rub shoulders and communicate. And this, he helped explain, was the source of free software, which was later in some quarters renamed as open source software, is what led to the success of this development model. Eric Raymond had a number of memorable phrases which helped explain why things work this way. He said, for example, "With enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. The point being that if you have enough people participating in the process, you're going to root out the bugs and produce a more reliable software than if you have just a handful of experts, even if they're well-paid and expert experts, for example, Microsoft. And he pointed out that the good software occurs not because there's a marketing opportunity, but because some software hacker, perhaps an anonymous one, not well-known, says, there's a problem that needs to be solved, and I want to solve it. So there's a passion behind open source software that's often lacking in the proprietary software. And there's a will to make the absolute best quality software rather than something that merely is marketable or good enough. The open source community takes pride in pushing things to the limit and being elegant and effective in the kind of software they write. Another memorable principle that Raymond put forward was release early, release often. And this is part of that Lamarckian evolution process. If you release the code frequently, you have more opportunities for people to comment and improve it and develop it further. So release early, release often. And then ideas like this, given a large enough beta tester and co-developer base, almost every problem will be characterized quickly and the fix obvious to someone. Again, treating the potential users as co-producers of the software. So that's an essay well worth reading, even though it's now quite old. Its basic principles still apply to the whole process. And Raymond wrote that essay at a time when Microsoft had a very different process, indeed a antisocial process for developing software. As the antitrust lawsuit against Microsoft revealed, Microsoft used what was called an embrace, extend, extinguish strategy, where they would embrace a software, extend their software into a competitive software like the web or Java or certain audio or video software, embrace it into the Windows platform. And because the Windows platform had such dominance over the marketplace for software, could then extinguish the competing software. Essentially, it was leveraging its monopoly power to shut down potential competitors, to turn common standards of software into proprietary standards owned by Microsoft. So again, it showed how open source software was one of the key ways to fight Microsoft, which was a rather formidable dominant force in structuring how software could be built in the internet age. Well, there's much more that could be said about open source software and its evolution. There's a number of worthy authors consulting, such as Christopher Kelty in his book Two Bits, The Cultural Significance of Open Source, Steven Weber, The Success of Open Source, Benjamin Mako Hill, who is a free software advocate and has written extensively about the community ethic and the other political issues surrounding free software. Gabriella Coleman, who's written extensively from an anthropological perspective. And Charles Schweik, a UMass computer scientist who has studied empirically the evolution of open source programs on SourceForge, a major website among programmers. But the point I want to leave is that the design of the internet and the evolution of free and open source software sort of set the stage for a radically different paradigm of communications, one that competes with the mass media broadcast model, and moreover, invents a radically new, globally decentralized, interactive platform for culture and communication in the 21st century. And the next lecture, week 10, will deal with some of these follow-on implications that the internet and free and open source software set down in the 1980s and 1990s.